You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1994 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the first class in a series given by Brother Clyde Snoblin on the subject, the Book of Hebrews.
Thanks, Jim, and good morning, everyone. This particular class for me started, as I suppose it did with Brother Noel, about 6 or 7 months ago when Brother Duncan came up to me after I had given an exhortation at the Saanich Ecclesia where he belongs. And he said, I want you to speak at Manuka this year. And he said, we've had trouble finding speakers and you're going to have to go. And so I said, well, that's fine. What do you want me to speak about? And he said, well, why don't you speak about Hebrews? And I said, well, all right, but why Hebrews? And he said, well, about 14 years ago, I attended a youth weekend up at Oyama Lake in Vernon, and you spoke about Hebrews. This was 1980, as he said, the year that St. Helens blew up. And that must have been the only notable thing in that year that I remember, because I remember Mount St. Helens blowing up, but I don't remember a thing about what I said about Hebrews. So, it's one of the things we love about Brother Duncan. He listens. He doesn't always do what I say, but he listens. And I think that's important, really. It's sort of, in a sense, gratifying that Duncan was listening anyway. And so, about 2 weeks ago, he phoned up again. I think it was the only time I talked to him in the 8 months, and said, so what are you going to call your class? What are you going to entitle your class? And I said, well, Hebrews, that's what you wanted me to speak about. What's the problem? He says, well, don't you have a subject? And I said, no, Hebrews. Good enough subject. So then I phoned him back about 2 days later, actually, and I said, well, I do have a subject. But of course, he wasn't there, which is one of the problems when you try and phone Brother Duncan. He's never there at home. It's a very nice home, but never there. And the subject that I was going to suggest to him when I called back was, is anybody listening? Well, he was. But that, brothers and sisters and friends, is so important to the whole study of this wonderful letter to the Hebrews. Is anybody listening? And why do we say that? Well, we say that because in chapter 1 and at verse 2, it says that God is speaking to us through His Son. God is speaking to us through His Son. And so it's such an important question that we ask, is anybody listening? The whole letter starts with that statement. And it ends in chapter 12 and verse 25 by saying, see to it that you do not refuse him who is speaking. See to it that you do not refuse him who is speaking. And he's speaking to us, brothers and sisters, through his Son. The letter to the Hebrews is about God's Son. It's about Jesus Christ. It's a subject that's very important to me because I think that in my experience in the Brotherhood, it's a subject that doesn't get enough attention. There's a whole letter to the Hebrews. It's about His Son, it's about Jesus Christ, and it's about words. And I'd like to say a few more things about words as we go along, but I got into words when I got a computer program, a Bible program for my computer. It's fun. And I know many of you have these now, and you can look up words. It does great word searches. And when I look at a letter like to the Hebrews, I start looking for words, and I start looking for occurrences of words, because there's keys there. I used to call these hooks, you know, you can take the message to the Hebrews and just hang it on certain hooks, and most of them are words. Now, because I have a Windows program, we call them windows, right? They're not hooks. What we want to do is open up some windows to you, the book of Hebrews. And these windows, the keys, are words. And I start off with three basic words. The first word is better. Now, when I say better, you'll probably start to think right away about all the times that the writer uses the word better. And I'm just going to give you a quick review. You don't have to look these up because we don't have time. But Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 9 says, even though we speak like this, dear friend, we are confident of better things in your case. So the writer is talking about better things. In this case, in the case of those who would be reading his letter. Chapter 7 and verse 19, for the law made nothing perfect, but a better hope is introduced. So right away, you see, this letter is about something that's better. It's better than anything that's gone on before. Better things are expected of the hearers, to those whom God is speaking through His Son. A better hope is introduced. And we'll see how that better hope is defined in relation to the old hope as we go along through this important book. Chapter 7 and verse 22, it says, because of this oath, Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. We've got better things, in our case, that are expected of us now. We've got a better hope that's introduced, and we've got a better covenant. And in Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 6, it says that it is founded, at the end of the verse, on better promises. So we've got better things, we've got a better hope, we've got a better covenant, we've got better promises. Oh, and in chapter 9 and verse 23, we have better sacrifices. What we're looking at now are sacrifices that are better than the sacrifices that have gone on before. And of course, the letter will define what those sacrifices are. In chapter 10 and verse 43, we talk about those who had suffered joyfully the despoiling of their goods. It said, you sympathized with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. There's almost a progression, isn't it, when you start to think about this, that we first of all have better things that are expected of all of us who are the readers and the meditators on this wonderful letter, but there's a better hope that's introduced. There's a guarantee of a better covenant. There are better promises. There are better sacrifices, and all of these things lead to a better and lasting possession. They're so much better than the possessions we have now. That's the point in verse 23 of chapter 9, or 34 of chapter 10. Hebrews 11 and 4 talks about those sacrifices again, where it said that Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. So there's a demonstration of what a better sacrifice is. We can have a look at that. Oh, in verse 16 of chapter 11, instead they were longing for a better country, heavenly one. Chapter 11, verse 35, women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. We don't quite know how to define that, but we'll have a look at that, God willing, as we go along. God has planned something better for us, chapter 11 and verse 40, so that only together with them we may be made perfect. So all those better things are for us, brothers and sisters. What a wonderful thing to think about. In chapter 12 and verse 24, so to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. We got better blood than the blood of Abel. So the first word I want you to think about, and again, these are little windows that we can kind of open up to remember, to access the book of Hebrews, to see what it's all about. The next word I've got is perfect. First of all, we've got better, and then we have perfect. And I have in chapter 2 and verse 10, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. Chapter 5 and verse 9, and being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation. And in chapter 7 and verse 19, it says, for the law made nothing perfect. We've got something better here. It makes perfect. In chapter 9 and verse 11, we've got a perfect tabernacle. It's a better tabernacle. It's a perfect tabernacle. Not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building. Chapter 10 and verse 1, it says, for the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never, with those sacrifices which they offered year by year continually, make the comers thereunto perfect. Couldn't make them perfect. But the new tabernacle, the new covenant, the new promises, can make them perfect. Hebrews 10 and verse 14, for by offering he had perfected forever them that are sanctified. So our perfection, brothers and sisters, comes through Jesus Christ and his offering. Chapter 11 and verse 40, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. We've already mentioned that verse. Made perfect altogether. We have to see this in an ultimate sense, of course. Chapter 12 and verse 23, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirit of just men made perfect. That's the hope. That's the message of Hebrews. And God is speaking this message to us through his Son. And the question is, are we listening? And the third word I have is eternal. And the word eternal comes up over and over again. The word eternal is eternal salvation in chapter 5 and verse 9. Chapter 6 and verse 2, it's eternal judgment. Chapter 9 and verse 12, it's eternal redemption for us. Chapter 9 and verse 14, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot. And finally, in chapter 9 and verse 15, it's the promise of eternal inheritance. Now, what does that mean? It means that there is something better for all of us, brothers and sisters. And that is what we're going to see spoken to us through this wonderful letter. Something better that can make us perfect. Something better that can perfect us like all that had gone before was impossible and capable of doing. And it'll bring an eternal reward. So remember those three words. Better, perfect, eternal. And there's lots of other words. There's the word impossible. We're going to have a look at that, God willing, in a couple of days. The word impossible comes up two or three times. And many others. And out of this letter, we want to draw your attention to what I'm going to call five exhortations. It's purely a subjective thing on my part that I've pulled out of the whole letter. Five different major exhortations that I think the writer has there. There are lots of little themes that run through the book. We're going to try and keep picking these up as we go along. The first exhortation, is about drifting. And to make it easier to remember it, I've got five words that all begin with D. First one is about drifting. That's in chapter 2 and verse 1. And these things all sort of hang together, as I say, because if we're looking at a better message, a better covenant, better promises, that can make us perfect, that will bring us to eternity, then when we throw in this whole exhortation about drifting, it's very important, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Because God is speaking to us, and are we drifting? We'll talk about that again. Chapter 2 and verse 1 to 4. Doubting the word. There's a progression that takes place in the mind of man. We start to drift, and then we doubt the word. In chapter 3, 7 to about chapter 4, verse 13, where the hard heart is described. And a couple of our brethren have already referred to that chapter in the brethren's exhortation last night, and our brother this morning in the first class. The hardening of the heart. So the second exhortation after drifting is about doubting, and the third one, which I have, is in chapter 5 and 11, goes through to about chapter 6 and verse 20, and I'm going to use the word dullness. Dullness towards the word. We can add the word after every one of these. Drifting from the word, doubting the word, and number three, dullness towards the word. And we might even kind of add another word, sluggishness. Now, that's not really a Hebrew word, and it's not in my program under Hebrews, but sluggishness, I think we understand what that means. The fourth is despising the word. It comes out in chapter 10 and verse 26 to 39. And then we're talking about willfulness. It's like saying, I don't want to listen. Right? That's what comes out. This willful despising of the word. And finally, defying the word is exhortation number five. Defying the word. Chapter 12, verse 14 to 29. And that's talking about refusing to hear. I don't want to hear. And God is speaking to us, brothers and sisters, today through his Son. Are we listening? And we need to see to it that we don't refuse him who is speaking. More words. This letter to the Hebrews is about Jesus Christ, any way you look at it. And we'll see why that is true as we proceed, hopefully. But Jesus Christ is presented not only as better than, he's presented as superior to prophets in chapter 1 and angels. Now, the Hebrews had a problem with prophets. They didn't listen to them most of the time, but they were big in Hebrew tradition. Angels, much bigger. Jesus Christ is superior not only to the prophets, but he's superior to the angels. And the angels were even more important than the prophets. Why? Because the angels were there, we're told, in chapter 2, at Mount Sinai, when the law was given. So the angels, in their hierarchy of things, were much more important than Moses, who received the law because the angels gave it. Jesus is superior to the angels. We'll see, hopefully, as we proceed, how each one of these points is so important to the presentation of Jesus Christ to the Hebrew Christian believers. Jesus is superior to Moses. Moses received the law from the angels at Sinai, but Jesus is superior to Moses, who built his house, who was superior and ruled his house. Jesus is superior to Moses. He built a different house. Jesus also, because of that, is superior to Aaron. He's superior to all the priests, all of the tribe of Levi, and what's more, to the Hebrew believer, to the Hebrew Christian. And, as a matter of fact, to all Jews of the day, Jesus Christ is superior to Abraham. Well, it only leaves Melchizedek, who is superior to Abraham, and Jesus Christ is superior to Melchizedek. Now, it seems to me that this message that is being penned here to the Hebrews, and I'll refer to the writer to the Hebrews, because I don't wish to enter into a debate or a concern over who wrote this epistle. I don't think it would even be fair to say who I think wrote it, because, again, this can be debated. A few things we know about this epistle. One is that it's written in a somewhat different style of Greek than the other epistles, and that's why some people say it probably wasn't written by Paul. Well, again, I don't want to get into that, but what I do know is, from everything that I've read and from what people tell me, is that this is really a different type of writing, this letter to the Hebrews, and I think maybe we can pick some of that, hopefully, as we go along. So it is different, but I think it began, the whole issue that is being presented here in this letter, in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, and I'd like you to go back with me, if you would, to 1 Chronicles chapter 21. You say, well, what does 1 Chronicles chapter 21 have to do with Hebrews? Well, I think, brothers and sisters, it has an awful lot to do with Hebrews. And I don't want to get into a discussion here. We don't have time to try and analyze what it meant in chapter 20, verse 1, when it said that Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel. But what I do think we can all accept was that there was a loss of focus in the kingdom of David. And the reason there was a loss of focus in the kingdom of David was because in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 5, this is what Moses said to the people: "But you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there for his dwelling. To that place you must go." Now that was basic to the establishment of the nation of Israel. It was the message that crossed Jordan. It was the message to this day and date, 1 Chronicles chapter 21 and verse 1, that had not been enacted upon. Well, David had taken the ark there to Jerusalem, but nothing else much had happened, it would seem. And the kingdom was progressing, and David had pretty much fortified all of his boundaries and his cities and established his armies, and there was a lot of wealth now coming into Israel, into the kingdom. And David had become very successful and very prosperous. And that may be part of what happens to the mind of great men as they become prosperous. And perhaps much could be said about that. But at any case, I think the focus was gone. And it needed to be reestablished. And David went out and did something that he wasn't supposed to do. And he submitted as a way of punishment to the hand of the Lord, who went through with his with his avenging angel and slew many of the Israelites over those few days. And the letter to the Hebrews began to be written on a stone. It was a stone that was used for threshing by a Jebusite by the name of Araunah. And David went there and he bought the particular place to offer, to make a sacrifice. And again, this letter, brothers and sisters, as do the whole scripture, has to do with sacrifice. And David went and bought it, and he said to Araunah in verse 24, but King David replied to Araunah, no, I insist on paying the full price. This sacrifice that was going to be made on this particular stone that day wasn't going to be cheap. It wasn't going to be free. It wasn't going to be a donation. It was going to be the full price to save the nation, paid by their king and redeemer, King David. And right there, brothers and sisters, would be where the name of the Lord would be witnessed to the world from this spot that he had chosen. And we know God chose it because the angel stood there. That's where the angel was that David met. We read about in the 21st chapter. Something very special about that particular spot. There it says in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 6, you bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes and special gifts that you have vowed to give, and your free will offerings as well. Everything. And the firstborn of your herds and your flocks. I have a spot, said the Lord to Moses and to the people, where my name is going to be. And the place where my name is, that's where you take your sacrifices, your offerings. That is where the witness of the saving grace of the God of Israel would go out to all the earth. That special spot. So this whole thing about the plague, as far as I can see, is a wake-up call to David. The focus had to be shifted. God required that this spot be established among the nations as a witness to all mankind, but also as a spot for the Israelites to take their sacrifices and offerings. And this, we know, in the next few chapters of Chronicles, became the basis of this great temple that Solomon built, where all the wealth of the nations literally flowed into Jerusalem, and all the preparations that David made, starting right at this point, as he offered his sacrifice on that stone, came together into one of the great wonders of the ancient world. I think we can all agree that it was a glorious temple. The wealth that Solomon had was unbelievable. It was incalculable. It was there for all the world to see that there was a God in heaven and that his name dwelt there in Jerusalem. And they could go up. It was an open invitation to the whole world. Sometimes we lose sight of that. It wasn't just to the Israelites. But all the world that passed by could see that the name of the God of Israel was there, witnessed by the miracle, the presence of his glory. That temple, of course, was destroyed by the Babylonians. One of the great tragedies of Scripture. A place that God had chosen to put his name finally bore the name of Tammuz in the gods of Babylon and Persia. And that question needs to come ringing down to us, brothers and sisters, today. Are we listening? You know, all of those words in the exhortation in the letter to the Hebrews are all there for us, exampled by their decline, by their drifting, by their dullness, by the fact that they defied and rejected the word of the God of Israel. Now, that temple, of course, was rebuilt somewhat modestly by those who returned after the Babylonian captivity. And it wasn't a bad place, but the problem was, I think, as we find from Scripture and from history, that it wasn't quite the way it was, even in terms of the glory of the God of Israel. Well, he did, it appear, return for a time. We don't have any indication that the ark was there. It wasn't really what it should have been. We have some fairly strong indication that there was a lot of Persian influence that had come into the reconstruction of that temple and of that area that surrounded the temple. And they'd say, well, that's so what? There was a lot of Phoenician influence in the temple that Solomon built. But it was worse than that, brothers and sisters, because the Persian influence that had gotten into the temple subsequent to the days of Joshua and Zerubbabel had a profound effect upon the worship of the God of Israel and upon his name in Jerusalem. Well, it was challenged, of course, by the Hellenizing influences of Antiochus Epiphanes and that whole time, that whole culture that challenged the name, including the sports arena that was built right outside the walls of the city, the Greek influence that got the young men of Judah involved in playing sports in the nude, in the arena. And that, of course, was a great abomination. And there were great struggles as a result of this. But finally, Herod, King Herod, who was an Edomite, who, I suppose for political reasons, as much as any, other than the fact that he had a little hang-up about the Jews, I think, history seems to record, the Jews just didn't go along with Herod the Great, so he thought, well, what I'll do is I'll build them a big temple. That's what the Jews want most of all. And he did. It took 40-some-odd years to build it, right over the same spot. And to further placate the Jews, he went down to Egypt and he brought back a course of priests that happened to be functioning there, worshiping in Egypt, and had for a couple of hundred years. He brought them back and set up the worship of, the Hebrew worship in the temple. And there was kind of a vestige of the name that returned for some time to the temple. But it was also the temple that Jesus wept over, because he knew that it would be removed, and it was destroyed this time by the Romans, and the name of the God of Israel removed from the rock and from the view of the world. And after a number of challenges by various Jewish groups over a period of 300 or 400 years to reestablish the temple. And during those years, including a revolt, 136, Bar Kokhba, the Roman general Hadrian, who finally took some of the remnants of the destruction of the old temple and built a big wall along one end and then just plowed the whole thing flat, made a great big flat table at the top. And of course, that wall is still there today. It's called the Wailing Wall. And a number of attempts, even by a group of Persians a few hundred years later, to rebuild the temple, to reestablish the name of the God of Israel. Well, it might have happened from a secular point of view, except for the advent of Islam. And one of the great peculiarities of history, one of the great watersheds of history, obviously aided and abetted by the hand of God, coming out of the deserts of Arabia, the belief in Allah, and Mecca, interesting, was the focus. And after the death of Muhammad, there was a number of caliphs who took over the empire. And the one who controlled Mecca controlled the loot. That's where all the money ended up, in Mecca. And this guy had a cousin by the name of Abd al-Malik, who happened to have this poor piece of territory in the city of, around the city of Jerusalem. The ancient city by this time was just a desolate place. Who cooked up the idea, it would appear from history, and I don't have the exact chapter and verse on this, but cooked up the idea that somehow Abraham was translated to heaven on a white horse from this rock. And so he built a covering over it. You can't really pronounce the Arab term, but it's still there today, interestingly enough. Called the Royal Covering in Arabic, to fulfill what Jesus said, that Jerusalem will be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And since that monument was built over that spot, the Jews have not been able to get access to the Temple Mount, to the place where the name of the God of Israel was meant to be. It was liberated by the nation of Israel in 1967. But no temple, no access, are not allowed there. And so the current conflict, brothers and sisters, the current situation that prevails continues to enforce the statement of Jesus. God intended that the world would learn of Him, would know His name because of a great temple that would be built in this particular spot, where the sacrifices of the nation and indeed the sacrifices of the whole world would be offered as a pleasing aroma to Him. Didn't work out. And so He caused it to be destroyed. He caused it through His providence to be uninhabited for 2,000 years. So He wasn't speaking anymore through His temple, through the building that He had erected over the stone of Arona, because God, who in the past spoke to our forefathers in this way, through His temple, through His priesthood, through His law, through the spot that He had chosen for His name to dwell, through endless prophets that came to the people with a message of hope and a message of condemnation to try and get them to change their ways. And at many times, and in various ways, throughout a few thousand years of history, has in these last days spoken to us through His Son, through whom He made the universe. And I won't get into that one. But in verse 3, the Son is the radiance of God. We don't need a Shekinah glory above a temple in Jerusalem, or above a tabernacle in the wilderness. We don't need a pillar of fire or a pillar of cloud. The sun is the radiance of God's glory. As a matter of fact, not only the radiance of God's glory, but the exact representation of His being, sustaining all things by His powerful word. In these last days, God is speaking to us through His Son, who is sustaining all things by His powerful word. After, of course, He provided purification for sins. He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty in heaven. So He became as much superior to the angels as the name He has inherited is superior to theirs. And that is the point, isn't it, from all of this? That when God spoke to Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and said, "But you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put His name there for His dwelling, to that place you must go," it was the threshing floor of Arona the Jebusite. And they were to take all of their offerings there. They were to take all of their sacrifices, their tithes, their special gifts, everything that they had vowed to give to the Lord, also their freewill offerings, the firstborn of their herds and their flocks. Now in these last days, and speaking to us through His Son, who bears His name, what is He saying, brethren and sisters? But this is the focus. Not a threshing floor, or a building, or an altar, as a place to offer sacrifice, but a Son who has the name, who has the name. That is who God has chosen. And He, we know, will soon return to this very spot at a time of God's choosing. And the name of the Lord will once again be established in Jerusalem. And the law will go forth from Jerusalem. And all nations will flow to Jerusalem. But it will be because of the Son. So he became as much superior to the angels in verse 4 of chapter 1 as the name he has inherited is superior to those. Because to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my son"? They were never referred to as sons. Psalm chapter 2 and verse 7, that didn't mean angels when it said, "You are my son, today I have become your father," or "today I have begotten you." He was talking about his son who would bear his name. Or again, "I will be his father, and he will be my son." 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 14. And again, when God brings his firstborn into the world, he says in verse 6, "Let all God's angels worship him." Deuteronomy 32 and verse 3. If there's any doubt, you're a Hebrew who had a little hang-up, or a big hang-up, about angels and about the hierarchy. God never said that to any of the angels. In fact, he said, "Let all God's angels worship him." The Son is superior to the prophets. The Son is superior to the angels. The Son is superior to the very rock itself. Verse 8, "But to the Son," he says, "Your throne, O God, will last forever and ever, and righteousness will be the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has set you above your companions by anointing you with the oil of joy." Psalm 45, 1 and 7. He also said, "In the beginning, O Lord, you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands." And a lot of these problem passages that come up need to be understood, brethren and sisters, in the awesome superiority that is given to Jesus. And the context of Hebrews is simply that he is superior to the prophets. He is superior to everything that had gone before, including the angels who the Hebrews revered so highly. "They will perish, but you remain." Verse 11. "They will all wear out like a garment. You will roll them up like a robe, like a garment they will be changed. But you remain the same, and your years will never end." Psalm 10, 25-23. To which of the angels did God ever say in verse 13, "Sit thou at my right hand until I make your enemies a stool for your feet"? Psalm 110 and 1? Never. They were all ministering spirits come to do God's will. And that sets us up for a very important point about the Son. They had no free will or free choice to decide whether they were going to serve God or not. They simply were ministering spirits sent to serve, programmed to respond to the bidding of God and to do his will. They served those who would inherit salvation. And that's why in chapter 2 and verse 1, and this message probably was stronger to the Hebrews than it would be to us, we must pay more careful attention. God is speaking to us in these last days through his Son. This was a message to the Hebrews, and it's to us as well. We must pay more careful attention, therefore, to what we have heard, so that we don't let things drift away. For if the message spoken by angels was binding, go back to Mount Sinai, and every violation and disobedience received its just punishment. One of the first acts was some man was gathering sticks on the Sabbath day, and he was stoned. What the writer is saying is, don't forget that. That was the law that was given by angels. And people died when they violated it. We must pay more careful attention. Because how shall we escape, verse 3, if we ignore such a great salvation that's better? It's as better, brothers and sisters, as the Son is superior to the angels. This salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed to us by those who heard him. God also testified to it by signs and wonders and various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit, distributed according to his will. No, it was not to angels that he subjected the world to come. They were there, as Job said at the beginning, to help him create it. That's what they did, but the world wasn't made for angels. It was made for man. And so what we see coming into this, brothers and sisters, is this whole problem of man. And what is man that you are mindful of him, the Son of Man, that you should care for him? That you created this whole world and put man there and made him, as it says in verse 7, a little lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor and put everything under his feet. And that takes us back to the early chapters of Genesis where man was to have dominion over everything. And I sort of think that the word dominion means dominion. It says rule in some versions. Man was given dominion over the earth. Not the angels, but it was made for man. And everything was put under his feet. Everything in subjection under the man and under the woman. And all the animals were brought before the man, and he named them. And if he came up with a name, God says, that's fine, that's its name. Everything. Right down to the little details. Everything put under his feet. And in putting everything under his feet, the middle of verse 8, God left nothing that was not subject to him. Yet with great sadness we have to report that at present, everything isn't in subjection to him, to man. Anything but. We see the world that God created and the man that he had put upon it in great confusion. As our first class just indicated this morning, hardly a world in subjection. A world in anarchy. But there's hope, verse 9, because what do we see? Jesus. We see Jesus. God's answer to the dilemma of man, who was made, and I had a little brief discussion with Brother Ray at breakfast this morning, I'm going to leave that one alone, who was made a little lower than the angels. It was different. He wasn't a ministering spirit sent and programmed to serve. The Son was different. And what was special about the Son that made him so different from the angels? Well, he's made lower than the angels. And he was crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death. None of the angels had done that. They were immortal beings, programmed to do God's bidding throughout eternity. The Son, though, Jesus, who we see, who is now speaking to us in these last days, was made lower than the angels. He's now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death. And that is an introduction to why it is, surely, that Jesus is so superior to the prophets, Moses, Abraham, Melchizedek, the priests, because he suffered death so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. Now, this is an affirmation of Jesus being greater than the angels that's coming up here. Jesus was superior to the angels. And because of that, we need to pay heed to that, because we can drift. And I think we understand, brothers and sisters, that in this great exhortation about drifting, that we never sort of just fall into a life of sin, do we? We don't just plunge into disaster like it just happened one day. Problem is, we drift. It's a little bit at a time. And when we're drifting, that's when our life is in greatest peril. And I suppose in a practical sense that when we're drifting, that's when the voice of God through his Son is becoming less and less audible to us. And it may be because we're not in his presence. And we'll get to that later, towards the end of this letter. The exhortation is to pay more careful attention, because the drifting life is the life of greatest peril. But the dominion, getting back to chapter 2, had to be regained, didn't it? The dominion that was lost through sin in the Garden of Eden had to be regained, and it was regained through the Son. It was regained through the Son because He was made, in verse 17 of chapter 2, like His brethren in every way. And these words are extremely important for us to remember, that each word that we read from chapter 2 and about verse 8 right through to the first few verses of chapter 3 are extremely important to our understanding of this voice and of this person that we are reading about here in this letter to the Hebrews. To remember, brothers and sisters, that God is speaking to us through His Son, that the message of salvation and the message of hope that each one of us shares today does not relate to some building somewhere, some great edifice, a church. It doesn't relate to some altar where animals are slain and the blood is poured out upon them. It doesn't relate to some law or some religion or some intellectual pursuit that we might be involved in one way or the other. The hope that we're talking about has everything to do with a person. And that person is the Lord Jesus Christ. Verse 10, in bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting for God, for whom and through whom everything exists, to make the captain or the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. To make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering. So that both, in verse 11, the one who makes men holy and those who are made holy are of the same family. We might add to that to say that they're made of the same stuff. And so perhaps we can pick this up tomorrow with this thought, that we see Jesus, and that is how God is speaking to us. And remember that in verse 18 of chapter 2, He says, because He Himself suffered when He was tempted, He is able. He is able. And those blessed words have to come down to each one of us to speak to our hearts this morning. He is able to succor. And the word succor, as I understand it, has to do with literally running to help a small child. He is able to help those who are being tempted.